conventional in discussing risk policy to break the problem into two pieces. There's risk assessment, where we figure out what risks we're looking at, and then there's risk management when we decide what to do about these. I'd like, before I start to talk about the risk assessment and management parts, to look, step back and look at what the goals of a successful risk management policy for nanotechnology might be. And since we live in democratic societies, whatever the goals of a government policy, the primary thing that the policy has to achieve is legitimacy with the public. If the public doesn't buy into it, it doesn't matter all the great reasons we have for it, it's not going to fly. But risk policy, making policy in general, is not just about catering to the public taste, although buy-in is absolutely essential for success. We also have to look at what we're trying to achieve through policy. We live in market economies, so policy has to help a market perform smoothly. Buyers and sellers need information. If the information is not readily available, perhaps regulation can help supply information that's needed to make transactions work well. We also, producers have to be able to plan for the future. So regulations have to be predictable, and they have to provide well-defined responsibilities and liability. But markets do well at regulating voluntary exposure to hazards. When we start talking about material we're going to release potentially, deliberately or inadvertently, into the air, into the water, into the soil, we're going to have involuntary exposure to hazards. And the most familiar part of environmental regulation is dealing with managing involuntary exposure. We can look at balancing the good that nanotechnology has to offer against the harms that it potentially inflicts on people against their will. We can also look at the distribution of risk among different groups. Are certain groups of people being exposed unfairly to grossly larger risks than the rest of the population? And we want to find a way to distribute risk equitably and keep it within acceptable limits, whatever the acceptable limits are. So I'm going to argue today that it's too soon for us to have a solid sense of what the risks we're looking at are. We only have the vaguest sense of a lot of the hazards associated with nanotechnology, and we only have guesses also about what the benefits that nanotechnology has to offer us. So doing a detailed, precise test of risk-benefit balancing simply can't be done in a meaningful way right now. What's much more important at this stage is to establish a process for developing rules in the face of uncertainty and for adapting to the inevitable surprises that will meet us as we move into the future. The process must be able to maintain a broad sense of trust across all the stakeholders, government agencies, industry, consumers, and others, and it has to be resilient in the face of the unexpected. I can't tell you what such a process will entail, but I'm going to try to explore some of the issues it's going to have to deal with. Now I'll return to the matter of assessing risks associated with nanotechnology. One widely used rubric that was laid out in the 1980s in a National Research Council report breaks things down into four steps. There's problem identification, there's putting together a dose response assessment, there's assessing exposure, and then there's performing risk characterization, where we pull together the identified problems, the dose response relationships for each of those problems, the exposure that people face to the hazards, and giving an overview of what the different risks are. In assessing the risks associated with nanotechnology, problem identification is difficult. To begin with, we have to define what we mean by nanotechnology. There's a very clear definition in the National Nanotechnology Initiative, but nanotechnology is also a marketing buzzword. It seems to sell products, so manufacturers are eager to slap the name on things that may not meet the NNI definition. Researchers have found that if the word nano appears in the grant proposal title, an extra zero appears on the funding request. At the back end, yes. So the word nanotechnology gets used very widely, and even within the narrow definition of the NNI, we're talking about two orders of magnitude of length scales. Particles at the 1 nanometer scale, or the 10 nanometer scale, or the 100 nanometer scale will all behave very differently, and depending on the composition, the size, and the shape, may pose dramatically different sorts of hazards. Certain particles can slip easily through membranes into the bloodstream, they can slip into cells, they can even slip into the nuclei of the cells and interact with DNA. Other particles do not. Some nanoparticles are chemically inert, other ones are reactive, other ones behave as catalysts. Right now, pretty much all the nanotechnology in today's products is labeled passive. It doesn't actively manipulate its environment, but in the future there will be great emphasis on active nanotechnology. This may include small machines, particles that change their size and shape in response to external stimulus, perhaps even the sort of microscopic robots that science fiction writers enjoy writing about. This vast array of nanotechnology means that we have to consider a huge range of possible problems and a huge range of possible productive uses to which we could put these technologies. Any attempt to predict what sorts of dangers or benefits these technologies are likely to bring is inevitably fraught with colossal uncertainty. Some forecasts suggest that the market for nanotechnology products will reach trillions of dollars within the next decade or so. It may revolutionize industry, medicine, benefit the environment by permitting cleaner manufacturing, creating new ways to clean up pollution in the environment, increase the efficiency with which we use energy and natural resources. Nanotechnology could possibly revolutionize medicine, allowing us to directly tinker with our bodies at a molecular scale, repairing defective genes, cleaning plaque from our arteries, destroying cancerous tumors. But today, the major markets for nanotechnology are things like cosmetics, sporting goods, paint, things that can hardly be described as essential to our economy. Nonetheless, the future holds great promise. Whether nanotechnology delivers on this promise is the big question. We all remember when the internet was going to create a long wave of prosperity, make recessions obsolete, break America's dependence on foreign oil by allowing everyone to telecommute, and it would drive the Dow to 36,000. Other technologies brought similar exaggerated promises. Nuclear energy would be too cheap to meter. Antibiotics would permanently eliminate infectious disease. The Green Revolution would eliminate hunger in the third world. And clean, safe nuclear fusion was just around the corner. Whether nanotechnology turns out to be truly revolutionary like the steam engine or the transistor, a bust like nuclear fusion, or a modest evolutionary success remains to be seen. Most of the benefits we are promised are still quite far from the marketplace. At the same time, it's very difficult to assess the hazards of nanotechnology. We're looking at a wide variety of materials in a wide variety of shapes and sizes. Hazards can include simple toxicity of the bulk constituents, such as cadmium, and in some ways this is no different from the hazard of anything containing such toxic elements or compounds. But hazards can also involve the small sizes and shapes of the particles, which allow them to travel deep into the lungs, through membranes, past the blood-brain barrier, perhaps into cellular nuclei. We're continually finding that small particulate matter air pollution is more deadly than we had thought, so there's good reason to worry about the effect of engineered nanoparticles. On the other hand, we can ask whether there's any reason to pay special attention to nanotechnology when there are so many other sources of nanoparticles in the environment, notably in diesel exhaust and industrial production of carbon black. Hazards can involve the special chemical properties of nanometer scale particles. Atoms at the surface of nanoparticles often behave in a more chemically active fashion than the same atoms on a larger particle. This presents the possibility of using nanoparticles as catalysts to clean up pollution from soil and groundwater or to make more effective catalytic converters to prevent air pollution. But it also creates the problem of persistent catalysts in the environment. As a sometime atmospheric chemist, I've spent some time studying another persistent catalyst, stratospheric chlorine. In the 1930s, Thomas Midgley, fresh from inventing leaded gasoline, dealt another blow to the environment by inventing chlorofluorocarbons. These were a miracle compound because at the time refrigerators used either very toxic or very explosive compounds as coolants. chlorofluorocarbons were safe, non-toxic, non-flammable, and looked like they posed no problem to human health or the environment. 40 years later, it was discovered that chlorine from these compounds would behave as a catalyst in the stratosphere, so that only parts per trillion of chlorine in the atmosphere could destroy virtually all the ozone over an area in the Antarctic much larger than the United States. This was possible because the catalytic reactions would cause one atom of chlorine to destroy over 100,000 molecules of ozone. What happens if nanotechnology produces small, environmentally persistent catalysts that go into the environment, in the water, in the soil, in the air, and catalyze reactions that will go on without depleting the catalyst? What would happen, for instance, in a fantasy of a benignly designed nanoparticle that's supposed to oxidize organic pollutants in the soil, which turns out to go ahead, spread through the soil, and catalyze the oxidation of all organic matter in the soil, releasing vast quantities of carbon dioxide and depleting the organic matter that's necessary for fertility. So if we look at these sorts of risks that we might face, and we look at the history of anthropogenic environmental hazards, it suggests that the most serious problems associated with nanotechnology are likely to be ones we have not yet imagined. There will be surprises coming up in the future. Once we identify potential hazards, assessing their magnitude, their dose-response relationships, exposure, and characterization is similarly daunting. Obtaining good measurements of exposure and dose-response relationships are exceedingly difficult and uncertain. As we do these assessments, we must keep in mind the question whether the risks of nanotechnology deserve special considerations and whether they deserve greater scrutiny than other environmental risks. Is there any reason, given that we've only characterized the hazards associated with a handful of the tens of thousands of chemicals in widespread industrial use, why we should focus especially on nanotechnology? At the same time, there are going to be special risks associated with nanotechnology and hazards that will emerge that we will identify as these move into use. The uncertainty in understanding the risks and the benefits of nanotechnology is clearest when we look at how the insurance industry views this. The CEO of Swiss Re, a major reinsurance firm, identifies nanotechnology, global warming, and terrorism as the three great threats the insurance industry faces, looking towards the 21st century, and he writes that nanotechnology is not a manageable nor even a definable field of risk. It's on the insurance industry's agenda because concerns over nanotoxicity or nanopollution, and because nanoproducts are expected to become omnipresent across industry sectors and countries. This introduces the possibility of long, latent, widespread, and unforeseen claims. Now, one problem in dealing with these risks is it's one thing to do quantitative assessments of costs, benefits, exposure, dose response, but when you start talking to the public, there's an emotional factor that comes into dealing with risk. People respond to risk in ways, there's a long literature I don't have time to review completely, on the way public and also experts think about uncertain risks. Things that evoke great amounts of fear or dread can become exaggerated. People tend to narrow their focus in thinking about risk to things that will occur in the near term and with great probability. If you look at the way people buy insurance, there's a tendency to buy tremendous amounts of homeowners insurance to cover things like windows breaking in a storm, which you can pay for out of pocket, and a failure to buy adequate insurance against the very rare catastrophic floods that could ruin somebody financially. We have to take this into account when we're looking at how to achieve public legitimacy on the risks. And we can look at cases, I won't go into this because I'm running out of time, but where people, one big problem we've run into is where people, experts, will give pronouncements prematurely that a technology or a substance is free from risk and completely safe, as the British Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries, and Food did in the late 1980s about beef consumption. And then when it turns out there is a risk, a hazard, even if it is fairly small, the breakdown in trust between public and government can completely disrupt the process, and it becomes necessary to look for ways to rebuild the trust, to rebuild consensus. Probably the most important problem facing managing risks of nanotechnology is achieving a consensus across the stakeholders about how to proceed, how to characterize problems honestly, and maintain trust when surprises arrive. Thank you for your attention.